family gives a channel for maleness and fatherhood and all these things to play out.
Yeah.
That then comes out sideways without that, right? Yeah. Comes out in aggression, like you said, crime, stuff like that. And I always find that fascinating. A lot of them, not saying that every guy needs to get married, not saying that all that, but there is a general macro level truth
yeah.
that like there is a channeling of wisdom and maturity that happens when men focus their energy here right. yeah. and build this
the civilizing influence.
Versus yeah. something else.
That's right. Yeah.
Hey guys, welcome to the Dads Building Teams podcast, where we chat about exactly that, dads building their family teams. Every week, me and my friend and mentor, Jeremy Pryor, alternate interviewing another father friend of ours about his particular journey as a father, pursuing the call to build a multi-generational team on mission. As always, let us know what you thought of today's episode on social media, at Family Teams, and without further ado, enjoy today's episode.
All right, guys, welcome to the Dads Building Teams podcast. This is going to be a special episode. We've never done this kind of episode before, but Jeff and I are hanging out.
Yeah, never one done an episode together either.
That's right. Yeah. So he's we got him in Cincinnati for a few hours.
Yes, and I'm up in my Dads Building Teams quota because I think I have like one or two in the docket, and you have right. like 12 or something.
That's right. You got to get to work.
Exactly.
Right? So we are wanting to dive deep into just a bombshell article that was written by David Brooks, released by The Atlantic, called Was the Nuclear so Family a Mistake? And so when I first came across this is a March edition article, so there's a lot of conversation buzzing in sort of the Christian family world about this yeah. article, and I've kind of looked at some of it, and man, I'm just like 95% of it just feels like misses
totally.
The main point.
Yep.
The thing that's amazing about this article isn't David Brooks' solutions. It's the first time I've ever heard any writer get this close to the root of the problem.
Yeah, the indictment was so not concise. It was so all in one place, mm-hmm. well researched. I think we even mentioned in the email too. Like it felt like a dissertation. It felt yeah. like a thesis. And so it didn't, because we've always had to fragment this conversation together, and it felt like mm-hmm. the indictment, the problem was finally one place. All the stats, all the backup, all the stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's funny. A lot of people, I didn't even care about the solutions. The thing I loved about the article was his indictment.
Right.
You know, like, and yeah, and some people are hung up on like his last couple of paragraphs, but yeah.
Right. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But what I really wanted to do is have a conversation with Jeff, just kind of like a free flowing, where we are just working through some of the high points of the article. And I just want for you guys to hear us reflect on this stuff, because I really think that this will, if you were wondering what the problem is yeah. with the family, by the time you're done listening to this,
you won't know the problem, or you will know the problem.
Yes. That's right.
Inside and out.
You'll be very familiar with it.
Yeah. Would you say it's helpful if someone's listening to this episode to stop what they're doing right now and go read the article first?
They might. I mean, we're going to read a lot of it.
That's true.
And, you know, there's a
lot. Synthesize. And it's right. a long article.
It's very long.
I started reading it at 10 p.m. in bed. I'll sometimes do that when an article hooks me. And I had to bookmark it and read it the next day, which that's rare. I was like, yeah. I couldn't get it. Probably was a 2-hour read or like an hour read. It was long.
It's long. It's
probably got to be 10,000-15,000 words or something. Yeah.
It's unusually long. So yeah, we'll read a bunch of this for you guys. I know a lot of you are probably like me and Jeff, and most of what you consume is audio.
Yeah.
And so probably a lot of you didn't get through it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I want to help you out. So we're just going to work through some of the high points, have a discussion around it. So he starts out, the title is, Was the Nuclear Family a Mistake? And right off the bat, this is, it's very provocative yeah. title.
Well, actually, I don't even think it's a question. Isn't it a statement? Isn't there no question mark? Doesn't he just say it was? Like, what, the nuclear family was a mistake?
What does he say here?
Which I think that's even stronger.
Yeah, that's.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think there's a question mark. I think it's like, why the nuclear family was a mistake, not why was it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
the nuclear family was a mistake.
Just declarative. It is done.
That's a good point. Yeah. Yes. I missed. Okay.
When you read that title, were you expecting it to be what it was? No. I wasn't. And no, I didn't know it was by him yet.
Right.
So when I first saw that
yeah.
and I opened it, I was expecting a lot more progressive,
right.
new,
an
modern vision. Yeah, exactly.
Article.
That was going to basically say, like, this has been a bad idea that's been holding right. us back from individual success
that's
and all
right.
that. And so it was a weird bait and switch that, like, and then I saw it was by right. Brooks, and then I knew I was in for a different version. I didn't know he was going to go where he went, but I yes. knew it wasn't going
to
be that.
Well, this kind of gets close to the problem. So there's two problems we're going to be teasing out. One is the one that Brooks is describing. There's a second problem that I'd like to sort of in tandem talk about, which is how much the church has misdiagnosed
yeah.
the problem.
Yeah.
And so when a Christian reads a title like The Nuclear Family Was a Mistake, we are going to immediately assume.
Well, it's pet language to us.
Right, that yep. you're attacking our ideal.
Yep.
Which yep. is, this is the, this is sort of gets to the root
That's
of
why
problem.
I love the article so much. Yeah.
That's right.
But yeah, and it's kind of like, those are, that's fighting words. Those are buzz, right. those are trigger words. That's triggering yeah. for religious conservatives.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are all about defending the nuclear family, and this is an idea that we need to, along with David Brooks, try to bring down.
Yeah.
This is killing us, this idea. And yeah. he really well describes why. This is something that through family teams we've been talking about for years, but this is something that I just haven't seen popularly discussed right. at all.
Which random tangent, you probably know this. I've never even thought about why is it called the nuclear family? Like, is it because of nucleus, right? Because the
right.
kind of like its small entity yes. fully encased in itself. Exactly. What is that, you're right?
Right. Yeah,
it's almost like the atomized family or something. Yeah,
it's not because of the nuclear bomb.
Yes, exactly. It's nuclear in the sense of nucleus.
Yeah, so it's basically
self-contained, small.
Yeah, small with a couple of orbiting
yes,
yep. protons or whatever. I'm not really
somewhere in that realm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
physics. But
it's a fascinating phrase, though.
Yeah, but that's what it's talking about, as opposed to a multi-generational family yeah. or an extended family. So the reason why you guys have heard us talk a lot at Family Teams about the multi-generational family is because we agree with Brooks that the nuclear family, as the ideal family,
yeah.
as the thing that we're all shooting for, that is a bad target.
Yeah,
it's got predictable flaws in it that are going to really hurt the family. And this was never God's design for the family.
Yeah. This was Pleasantville's design for the family.
That's right.
Which yeah. was that Tobey Maguire, Reese Witherspoon movie. I love that movie.
That's right. All right, guys. So we're going to just kind of work through this thing. He starts off by talking about a movie called Avalon, and the director Levinson said, "In my childhood," this is a quote from him, "you'd gather around the grandparents and they would tell the family stories. Now individuals sit around the TV watching other families' stories." And then that's the end of the quote. He says, "The main theme of Avalon," he said, "is the," quote, "the decentralization of the family, and that has continued even further today. Once families at least gathered around the television, now each person has their own screens." So Avalon, it's a great movie. I'd encourage you guys to watch it. April and I just watched it last week, and we both loved it. We're going to show our kids, and we want to have a whole conversation. But basically what happens is a immigrant, multi-generational extended family emerges in Philadelphia. They live together. They live on the same street. They're always hanging out. And then he shows basically in a few different epochs the disintegration of this family. And so it begins with a scene where, you know, they're all together. There's a huge table. There's kids and grandparents and generations and five brothers. And then it goes from there towards the end of the movie. You know, you basically have family just watching TV while they're sitting alone in their nuclear family. And Levinson's just like, guys, this is the problem. And the article, David Brooks goes on to write, "This is the story of our times, the story of the family, once a dense cluster of many siblings and extended kin, fragmenting into ever smaller and more fragile forms. The initial result of that fragmentation, the nuclear family, didn't seem so bad. But then, because the nuclear family is so brittle, the fragmentation continued. In many sectors of society, nuclear families fragmented into single-parent families, single-parent families into chaotic families, or no families." So he's saying the problem here with the nuclear family isn't necessarily that you should feel bad right now. Yeah. If you're a nuclear family, you, your spouse, and your kids living together in a house. That's fine. The problem is that making that the ideal, it's too fragile.
Yeah.
There's too many ways for that to blow up. You're always one divorce away, one bad sort of health crisis away. If you're too many kids,
yeah.
There's so many ways for that to be taken down. And especially with the rampant rise of divorce, it's too fragile. And this fragility has led directly to a fragmented society where now people are living and being raised in these fragments of the family. And this all really, again, I think we have to diagnose this properly. What Brooks is saying is that in an extended family clan, when there are grandparents and aunts and uncles and there's a sense of cohesion with the extended family, that holds the nuclear family and yeah. serves the nuclear family to such a degree that there are all kinds of ways for those family members to step in.
Yeah.
The problem.
Well, I think two things that I think of too when I remember reading even the first couple of paragraphs in the article. One is that really distilled example he gave of the movie, but then also like this picture of like, he didn't say it exactly like this, but this is the vision I was getting of like
that ideal again, because we are the stories we believe, we are the ideals we believe, right? Yeah. We become those, we become what we worship, what we are, our affections start turning towards there. And you know, 100 years ago, kind of the family picture on the mantle was, you know, 20 people, right?
Yeah.
Three or four generations, gray hair, babies, toddlers, etc. Then it went down, you know, 50 years ago, then it went down to now that picture on the mantle is kind of this ideal Christmas dinner of a family is now eight people, right? And it's maybe one grandpa or grandma, yes, or, you know, and then the ideal now, or maybe, you know, probably from the 50s or 60s on, 70s on, is then the nuclear family, right? Okay, now it's, and yet literally that is literally actual pictures.
Right.
Like from the Leave It to Beaver, like that of a mom, dad, two kids, is like that cartoonish picture of now that's the ideal Christmas dinner. And now today, like, you know, the ideal would be like, you know, anything, right? At some level. And we're not saying that like smaller, bigger all of a sudden means better in the sense of amount of kids. Don't hear us say that's conflation, but conflating what we're talking about. But I think we have to be careful or just understand that like we need to realize how quickly of a shift has happened in 100 years of these different visions of what we used to believe family is and now what we believe family is, right? Yeah. Or now what we see it as. And I think the one language, the language that he used that I really liked in the beginning is, you know, he says extended family all throughout, but he really uses this phrase a couple times, corporate family, which I really liked, of like kind of this corporation. Like family was more of a corporation 100 years ago when now it's like a nuclear tiny little entity.
Right.
And I think it's very easy to think that the 1800 ideal from a family to the one we have now is very similar, just shrunken, when I think that's wrong. I think it's actually like these are apples and oranges.
Yeah.
Like the corporate family was like a different thing than the nuclear family. Right. It was a businessy, corporation-like.
Had economic life.
Yes, economic life. It was a web of resources, a web of catching the fragility and the hardship, different roles, different missions, different purpose. Then nuclear family. Nuclear family is more about consumption.
Right.
Nuclear family is about making your life better.
Right.
In like a very pseudo,
and
you know, shallow way.
The economics, outsourcing.
Exactly.
All the other.
So it isn't, I think it's, we have to start there too of defining our terms where we're not just saying like, have a bigger family.
Right.
Right. Don't, or just, or bring in your extended family. It's like, no, the corporate family versus the nuclear family are actually two different beasts.
Right.
That do different things, that have different identities, different missions.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. And just to also say that the goal, you guys, we know we can't go back to some perfect time in the past, but what is critical is that each of you listening to this has a vision of the kind of family you want to build.
And that we stop chasing the one that's going to lead to just bad things.
and so if you just grew up in the church, or you just read a lot of most of what is written about the family, or you just haven't thought about it and just got a lot of your information from culture.
Yeah, it's trying to restore the nuclear
family. Yeah, I really think that your vision of what you're trying to build is this sort of fragile nuclear family. And we want to see you guys have a high resolution vision of the kind of family God actually had in mind when he designed the family. What the kinds of things that you see God creating in, first of all, in Genesis 1 and 2, then what is created through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Again, it's not that these guys were perfect. It's that there was an architecture behind the family that was extended, that was multi-generational, that was a team, and that was on the same mission.
Yeah.
That's a different idea.
Well, two different ways people tend to commonly respond to this, or maybe only one way, but there's two ways that we need to think about it that are different. We hear stuff like this, and I know for me, even early on in the family journey, and still now early on, it's easy for me to think like, oh, that's not, you know, corporate family, extended family, huge and big and multi-generational, all that stuff. Like we're way long gone from there. We've missed that. We can't do that. We can't achieve that. It's easy to hear that and then immediately feel shame or guilt or just like almost like bitterness. I feel like that comes out in sometimes of like never, that's a pipe dream. It's never going to happen. So you can either think that when you hear this, but what you don't realize is usually when we think that, we're thinking that because we want to reap the benefits from our family. Like we're doing that for us.
Right.
When a better perspective is, hey, how about I just put my head down for the next 50 years, and when I'm about to die, I bet I'll be closer to this version of a family.
That's right.
So it's more about your next generation and what you're giving them than like, oh, I can't have that right now, so I'm really bitter. Does that make sense?
What kind of family do you want your grandchildren to
live in? Not just the one you want.
Right. And you can build that kind of family, even, you know, whatever stage you might be listening to this in. But obviously, it's going to be a lot of work, like Jeff is saying. Okay, now the second thing that Brooks brings up is the rise of individualism, which is something we talk a lot about in Family Teams. And he says some really interesting things about it. I want to read this. He says, if you want to summarize the changes in family structure over the past century, the truest thing to say is this: we've made life freer for individuals and more unsustainable for families.
That line just jumped out at me. I remember I read that and I was like, yes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I love, he then goes on to really tease out what he's talking about. We've made life better for adults, but worse for children. We've moved from big, interconnected, and extended families, which help protect the most vulnerable people in society from the shocks of life, to smaller, detached nuclear families, a married couple and their children, which give the most privileged people in society room to maximize their talents and expand their options. The shift from bigger and interconnected extended families to smaller and detached nuclear families ultimately led to a familial system that liberates the rich and ravages the working class and the poor.
Oh, I love that part too, because I feel like it's so easy to hear this argument or talk about family and ideals and all that, and we immediately think of the opposite. We think that's, you know, that's kind of only for the rich, or that's only for the wealthy. And I like how he turns it on its head of like, it is, the nuclear family is, right? But the extended family one is for everyone. Like, like if you want to actually protect the vulnerable and the children and the outcasts of the family and the people that are more on the fringes, then the corporate extended family is the way to do that.
Right.
Rather than like, we think building the big one is the one that's only privileged people can do, when it's like, no, only building the nuclear is the only one that privileged people can do. And I love that part.
Yeah. And so in this definition of freedom, that he's talking about, which the individual, desire to basically enjoy a completely unencumbered life, that value has been what chasing that value takes you down this road of basically, extended families are messy.
Yes.
So he then goes on to really talk about that. Like, he calls it the era of extended clans. And he says some historical things I thought were really helpful. So he says, through the early parts of American history, most people lived in what by today's standards were big sprawling households. In 1800s, 3/4 of American workers were farmers. Most of the other quarter worked in small family businesses like dry goods stores. People needed a lot of labor to run these enterprises. It was not uncommon for married couples to have 7 or 8 children. In addition, there might be stray aunts, uncles, cousins, as well as unrelated servants, apprentices, and farmhands. Stephen Ruggles, a professor of history and population studies at the University of Minnesota, calls these, quote, corporate families. Jeff's talking about that. Social units organized around a family business. According to Ruggles, in the 1800s, 90% of American families were corporate families. Until 1850, roughly 3/4 of Americans older than 65 lived with their kids and grandkids. Nuclear families existed, but they were surrounded by extended or corporate families. So this idea there, and I have mixed feelings about the word corporate, because I think I agree. What I like about it is it brings in the economic
and kind of like organizationally structure. Yeah.
Obviously,
like an entity, an enterprise. It's almost an enterprise family.
The hard edge to that word is, of course, like we think about kind of nameless, faceless.
Yeah, corporate always means dead, dry. Yeah, exactly.
But I think that, you know, getting into the details of what Stephen Ruggles and David Brooks are saying here is that, look, there was a time period where just about everybody lived in a kind of family that had this extended family dynamic, and at the core of the extended family, or maybe there was multiple cores, were family businesses.
Yeah.
And so that gave economic dignity to every person in the family, that allowed children to provide economic value for the family. And so it created this sort of team environment that, and of course you could take advantage of that. There's a lot of downsides to that, but there was also just a ton of like cohesion and stability that was given to families because of that. And so I think that movement away, for people listening to this today, you have to decide. And one of the things I find amazing is all the affluence that have been created since the 1800s actually makes it more accessible to create these kinds of families, in terms of we have more tools, more resources, more options. It's cheaper. Like for most people, if you added up all the square footage that your entire extended family, your parents are living in, and you added all that up and took all the resources that are actually being invested in each of your individual family units, and looked at how wealthy your extended families are right now, you're vastly more wealthy than
back then,
than these 1800s families.
Yeah, because almost each little nuclear family has their own economy and enterprise and income. And you're right, it would be like triple, quadrupled.
Yeah, so the decision not to do this is a decision.
Yeah.
That's what I want to point out. You could decide if, you know, and of course this is not as simple as deciding, but if you with, you know, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, parents, grandparents decided to create and value living more multi-generationally economically, this would be really simple. Now, if and it would save you all a ton of money, it would take a massive transition. But the problem isn't that we suddenly, I just want to point out, the problem isn't that it's harder today financially. The problem is that it's really an idea problem.
Yeah.
Like, we don't value this. We value nuclear family. We value individualism. And those values have given rise to decisions that are incredibly expensive.
Yeah.
And so what he's describing here, anyone listening to this could say, look, in 10 or 20 years, I want to live that way.
Yeah.
And you can pull it off.
Well, and I feel like, too, and he talks about this at the end of the article, but I feel like it's pertinent actually more here than his solutions and resilience and all those things that we can talk about next, is that little section he talks about at the end where he goes through that chart of wealth versus how many people you live with. Do you remember that chart? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fascinating.
The wealthier you get, the fewer people.
Yeah, fewer people you live with. Yeah. And he basically said, he makes this argument where, and he doesn't make an argument, he just points to the data and says, it is very clear that the more you get developed in a country, and then personally, the more wealthy you become, the more you use your resources to buy privacy.
That's right.
And I just thought that was fascinating because that is antithetical to the vision of the gospel of extended families, right? So like, I do think that's the American narrative of that you use your money and your resources and your talents to actually get away from your family, to get away from even your actual nuclear family, like get away from your wife, get away from your kids, more hobbies, more whatever. That's the American narrative. But the Christian narrative is the opposite. Like, you want to actually gain, pool, get momentum on resources to then pour back into the family, to get, spend more time with them, to build them, to, you know, merge businesses and family, to all that stuff, right? And I thought that was a fascinating, I just never thought about that, of like how there's actually very obvious verifiable data that, which makes sense then, right? Because when you go spend time in Uganda, like I have, or some other places in Mexico and some of these other places that would be a little bit more rural, a little bit more poverty stricken, a little bit more kind of second or third world in development, they're all together, right? Yeah. And I forget what the country, maybe Nigeria, where he's like their average of like living with 13 people or whatever. Right. That's mind blowing to us, right? But I don't know, what fodder does that do for you? Of just like, man, that's interesting.
What I think is happening there is that we have a, like every single person, every one of us has a lifestyle ideal. Like there's a trajectory we're headed towards. Now, if you haven't thought about this, then what Jeff just described,
you'll probably go to the
hyper individual. Like, there's no end to that except for living and dying alone.
Yeah.
Now, we don't realize that, but that's that
where it'll take
because you value freedom, individual freedom more than anything else. Now, what I encourage people in terms of a lifestyle ideal that are raising families to replace with the sort of just the totality of being as individualized as possible. Replace that with the lifestyle ideal of living your ideal week. So the reason there's a huge difference, because
rather than your ideal finish line, a lot of times people are living that.
Well, and I wouldn't swap individual freedom with, I wish I could be around family as much as possible.
Like
that would burn most people
out.
I'm a hyper introvert.
That
doesn't sound like
that's a good
like
point.
Happy to me. So but I want to have deep relationships with my parents, with my kids, with my grandkids.
And they have to be built in or else they won't happen.
That's right. So what I think that we're so far off the target. We have basically misordered values.
Yeah.
There is something good about individualism.
Yeah.
There's also something really good about deep, long-term family relationships. So we don't have a template to balance these things. And that's what we need. And so if you think about your ideal, like how much time are you spending with, you know, the upstream generation, with your parents? Like for me, we integrate with my parents about 3 times a week, right? That's great. Like, you know, I hang out, my dad and I leave a Bible study every Thursday night with men. You know, my mom cooks dinner for the entire extended family every Tuesday. We do a big Shabbat dinner on Friday, and then they do worship with us on Sunday night. So 4 times a week, I know I'm hanging out with my parents in environments in which, you know, we're interacting, we're using our gifts together, working as a team. You know, they're in their 70s. I love it. Like, it's a great experience. But we slowly moved that direction over about 10 or 15 years of pursuing our ideal week.
Yeah.
Likewise, you know, with each of my kids, and with April, I have a similar level of intentional integration that we achieved through moving increasingly towards what we thought was the proper balance of these values. And what we have instead of that, if you don't craft that, then the culture will hand you what is their values, and you just pursue that value, you pursue that individual freedom value, and you end up dying alone.
Hey guys, did you know we have another podcast called 5 Minute Fatherhood? In it, Jeremy and I take 5 minutes every day to bring you a quick tip or piece of wisdom that will help equip and encourage you on your journey as a father living in God's design as the coach of your family team. Find it or listen and subscribe by searching 5 Minute Fatherhood on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere else podcasts are at.
Well, and that's what I like about two things. One, yeah, I think I always think of the analogy of like, you know, tubing down a river, right? All you have to do is sit in the tube and the current of the river will take you down the river.
Yeah.
But if you want to go upstream and against the grain, meaning like do something differently, then you have to literally like put one foot in front of the other. Right. You know, you don't have to do anything to go downstream.
That's right.
And so I think it's true with us, a lot of us family. We think we're stronger than that, right? We think if we just kind of chill and do things with good morals and kind of do our best, that, you know, we'll be fine. But it's in reality, it's like, that's kind of you just flailing on the tube floating downstream.
That's right.
Right. You have to intentionally have a plan to go upstream and actually kind of be actively participating. When going downstream, you can be mindless. Yes. You don't have to pay attention. And then two, that's where I really like the corporate language again, because I feel like, yeah, that's where, like, imagine any business where, you know, you're not having any touch points with the engineers in the company, or you're not having any touch point with the, you know, the more executive team over here, or like it's like you can't run a corporation or a business unless you're being extremely intentional with divvying up your time, how you're touch pointing all the divisions, all the realms, all the places to get the mission done, right? Yeah. And you have to kind of schedule it in or build it in. And I think a corporate family does that really well. Nuclear families tend to just think it's going to happen on accident.
That's
or something,
right.
Yeah.
So I want to tease out too, he gives a couple of reasons why extended family is really valuable. Now, I know a lot of you guys listening to this have like upstream generations where you're like, I don't think integrating with them is healthy for my family. That does not preclude you from this conversation. There's really two kinds of people who talk about this a lot. There's sort of a Isaac and Rebecca generation, like my family, which is, that means that the upstream generation are believers and there's a lot of reason to work towards some level of integration one step at a time. There's also Abraham and Sarah families, which is, you know, God's calling you away from a previous generation. So God called Abraham away from his father's household, away from Terah, but he didn't call Isaac away from Abraham. He didn't, you know, so that's the difference. Now there's two superpowers that David Brooks goes on to say that extended family has, and I think it's really worthwhile to consider what we've lost here. He says, extended families have two great strengths. The first is resilience. An extended family is one or more families in a supporting web. Your spouse and children come first, but there are also cousins, in-laws, grandparents, a complex web of relationships among, say, 7, 10, or 20 people. If a mother dies, siblings, uncles, aunts, and grandparents are there to step in. If a relationship between a father and a child ruptures, others can fill the breach. Extended families have more people to share the unexpected burdens when a kid gets sick in the middle of the day or when an adult unexpectedly loses a job. A detached nuclear family, by contrast, is an intense set of relationships among, say, 4 people. If one relationship breaks, there are no shock absorbers. In a nuclear family, the end of the marriage means the end of the family, as it was previously understood. Man, and so we talk a lot about that is the definition of fragile.
Yeah.
You know,
one thing away from just crumbling.
That's right. Yeah. In multi-generational family lines, divorce or some of these events could hit me a serious hit, but there's a lot to absorb.
Yeah, there's a lot more.
Move that family, continue to move that family forward.
Well, and one thing too, before the socialization one, I think, you know, I think what's interesting too is what that rarely plays out today. Like, we are deeply fragile, you know, we're one divorce away from just it all crumbling or whatever. But I feel like one place that I think it does play out where it kind of echoes this well is I've noticed, single mothers, I feel like, tend to, and of course there's a lot that where they do get, you know, kind of you know, they're not caught in a web. Yeah. But I feel like actually I do feel like that's where one still culturally appropriate place where the corporate or the extended family steps in, right? Yeah. Where that, like, single mothers get kind of absorbed into almost another orbit of family, with grandparents, with people, with aunts, yes, uncles. And I think that's a really kind of small, tiny sliver of what it should be all across the board.
That's
with
right.
Any person, with any age, with a grandparent getting ill, with a kid getting hurt, with a divorce happening, that it should be able to be absorbed. And if you're listening too, you know, two things. One, you can maybe be thinking like, man, I don't have that at all. Don't feel bad about that. Just be like, I want to, again, spend the next 30, 40 years building that for my kids. Right. And then two, I think, like, asking yourself like, yeah, what, maybe you do have that. And so then, like, who would that be and how, what would that look like? But I think that's really important to be thankful for that.
Yeah. Mothers and grandmothers, I think, tend to lead the way in our society.
Totally.
because they don't abandon the family as often or as predictably as fathers and grandfathers. I was just, when we were driving to the airport to Orlando last week, our Uber driver, you know, she's like talking and chatting and she's like, I have 40 grandkids.
40?
Yeah, 40. And five or six of them are living with me. And so she talked to us in detail about, you know, because she had so many kids, you know, there was a number of divorces.
One for she had the brunt.
So she at any given time has five or six grandkids.
Have you watched Cheer, the Netflix documentary?
No.
Have you heard about it? It's like all the rage right now. So if you're listening, let us know if you watched it.
Yeah.
Me and Alyssa loved it. It's like one of our favorite binge watches. It's like a 6-part docuseries about this cheer team in Texas Community College that always wins the national championship every year. But she specifically kind of specializes in like taking in really hardened or hard or difficult kind of life circumstances where cheer kind of becomes the thing that gives them purpose given them purpose. But the way they tracked what I was going to get, there's a girl on the show, one of the cheerleaders named Morgan. And yeah, her story was just really powerful where the parents just, man, brutal story on both the parents' sides, but the grandparents totally absorbed her. So she lives with the grandparents, stays with them. She praises them. And I'm just like, man, it shows you that like, what if those grandparents weren't there? She would be, you know,
what a disaster.
Done and out. Yeah, totally.
So I agree 100%. And so that's the resilience of the extended family. And then the other reason, which I found interesting, he said, superpower of extended family is socialization. Many people in Britain and the United States, he writes, doubled down on the extended family in order to create, this is during the Victorian era, a moral haven in a heartless world. According to Ruggles, the prevalence of extended families living together roughly doubled from 1750 to 1900. And this way of life was more common than at any other time before or since. During the Victorian era, the idea of hearth and home became a cultural ideal. One of the things that really blew me away that he's saying a superpower of extended family is socialization, is that if you ask most people, particularly Christians, or you know, when I ever have this conversation, like, are your kids socialized?
Yeah.
Primarily, they're asking, are they going to school, and are they spending the majority of their time in same age peer groups?
Yeah.
That's what socialization means.
Yeah, socialization means that your kids just know all the cool apps that all the other teenagers know and stuff like that.
And socialization, and so what he's saying is that there was a culture-wide consensus between the United States and in Britain for 150 years that what socialization meant was raising children in extended families.
Wow.
That they would then know how to relate to parents
all
and grandparents.
Ages, businesses,
they'd know how to
family.
Relate to siblings and to younger children.
Yeah.
And that was the definition of socialization, and it created what they called a moral haven, which was you were made aware of your moral obligations and a deep understanding of morality that was enhanced by this web of upstream and downstream relationships. And so we've replaced that idea with socialization, meaning can you make friends? And what's ironic is I know for a lot of people, you know, you live in that way through maybe your school years and maybe in college, but then suddenly you find yourself, if you were raised in a sort of a hyper same age
friend
peer environment. You don't
those
know how to relate.
And those like, poof. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you find yourself from the ages of 25 until you're 80, primarily living in intergenerational relationships.
I always find it fascinating that this is just something I always think about, how much in the West we value and invest in like the best friend culture and don't invest in like sibling culture, when literally there's so much data and just like almost everyone even can, from a conjecture standpoint, can back up that like, yeah, they've probably had multiple best friends, but like they still have the same sister or brother. You know what I mean? Like you won't have a best friend for 80 years, but you will have a brother or sister for 80 years.
Yes.
And so just be proportional. I just like, it's just economics. Just like be proportional with your investment.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. So and then he talks about the downside. We've kind of mentioned this a little bit. He says, but while extended families have strengths, they can also be exhausting and stifling. They allow little privacy. You are forced to be in daily intimate contact with people you didn't choose. There's more stability, but less mobility. Family bonds are thicker, but individual choice is diminished. You have less space to make your own way in the life. In the Victorian era, families were patriarchal, favoring men in general and firstborn sons in particular. I would love, this is like, I mean, David Brooks basically drops this idea of the downsides. I certainly would challenge a lot of these things and say there are elements here. Everything he wrote here to me cuts both ways.
Totally.
There are hard parts. By downside, he's really saying in every single one of these examples that it reduces individual freedom, which is kind of where we started. And it's true. Like if you decide that you want to live life as an extended family, it's going to be hard to move, you know, very far away from that. If you decide to have your parents move in with you, you're going to lose some privacy.
Yeah.
Now, I think, like I said,
Which some of that's for sanctification and growth.
Yeah.
Some of that is stifling. That's actually, maybe you shouldn't go that far. That's hard.
Yeah. So these are all sort of dials. Like in our life, for example, like I described, for most people, because we are all hyper wealthy, if you pooled all of our money, we realized this. And so it wasn't difficult for us to combine four households into one and end up spending a lot less money than any of us spent. So when my mother-in-law moved in, my parents moved in, our adult children moved in, we have four houses in one house right now, and we spend a fraction of the money that if you were to add all those up. Now,
well, it makes you realize too how many people are wasting so much money.
That's right.
Because, you know, this person, you know, in the family has a $2,500 mortgage. This person has $2,000 rent. This person has this. And now, you know, the whole family's probably doing over $10,000 in rent.
Now we took that money, even though it was a fraction of the money, and we bought privacy. Mm-hmm. So in our case, we have four kitchens.
Yeah.
You know, there's every decision we have to sort of be together rhythmically is a intentional decision still. Like we could all be isolated in sort of this family compound we live in. But I just want to point out, I get that when the extended family was living in a three room house, a lot of these things were really rough.
Yeah. I feel like that's not as much of a problem anymore, in the sense of like, you can kind of in an enormous blessing way, you can kind of have it both ways.
Yeah.
Right. And I always am thinking about the conversation where I think, you know, because at the same time, I think I wouldn't even say the word balance. I almost feel like it's like a 70-30 type thing instead of a 50-50. But like, yeah, we've completely lost the vision of like team, multi-generational families, et cetera, at the expense of hyper-individualism. But individualism and the you know, classic liberalism politically, not like liberalism as like, you know, has brought so much immense blessing. And if you can combine the two in their own ways, I do think the liberalism or the individualism is subservient to more of the team one. But if it's taken into account, then I think it is better than the ancient model, because the ancient model did go heavy, more patriarchal, a lot heavier, you know, male-centered, male-dominated, a couple of these other things that I think we can mitigate against while still holding all of the blessing from then, right? So then kind of combining into basically a best of both worlds that I think is very, very strong, because we don't want to go back to like, and basically too, like we never want to idealize the 1800s, right? The 1800s still had like, you know, sometimes this system really supported like abusers or people with a lot of power or guys or all these different things. And one thing too that I was realizing too that he talked about earlier, well, he didn't talk about this, but you know, like extended families kind of protect the most vulnerable. Yeah. I would say sometimes the multi-generational extended family at some ways also was at the expense of the most vulnerable. And what I mean by that is sometimes I think extended families have to be really careful. I think nuclear families or more individualized families or someone's that are caring for those values have to be careful to make sure they're still as a team, still on mission, still multi-generational. The multi-generational side, I think, sometimes has to be very careful that no, they're not going so far that always the most vulnerable are basically the least listened to or cared for. Right. Does that make sense? Like the usually that just means, because
I think what you're describing too is because they were an economic, there was an economic component. If somebody couldn't provide or
then you were just kind of dispensable.
It was possible for that family.
Or you were just like along for the ride.
That member,
basically. So kind of, and it's just classic group think and classic team dynamics, even if it's a sport, but the one who's producing the most, who's leading the most, generally just kind of drives the ship.
Right.
And so then you put that on the bottom side of the spectrum, the one who's producing least, the youngest kid, the quietest kid, the shyest kid, tend to then get our collateral damage. So there is collateral damage possibilities in the more classical model.
Yeah.
So if you can make sure you're mitigating against that while combining them together, then I think that's just a dream scenario.
I love what you're saying. Yeah, basically you're saying that we can create we have all the tools.
Yeah, we basically have finally where both, we see the blessings of both.
The only difference is that we have to be intentional, whereas in the 1800s, they didn't really have a choice.
Exactly.
Like they for survival, they needed to rely on the extended family. Now, because we have a choice, it requires one extra step of intentionality. But what you get for that extra step of intentionality is all of the wealth and the resources of this modern world to put against a even better model for the extended family.
And even just like what we've been taught now about psychology and child development, et cetera, even just thinking of I just really don't think back in the day that they cared that much about the five-year-old. You know, I'm just like, just you're not dying, you have food, you're good.
You'd be seen and not heard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. When now, I think if you can combine that, no, it's so important, you can, you know, tease them out and emotions, et cetera, while saying, but like, this is where the ship's going, you're not driving it, but you're contributing, we want to give value, all that.
Yeah.
Put all that together, I think that's magical.
I agree. And so then David Brooks started to talk through the transition that's happened between these two models. He said, The families they started were nuclear families, talking about after this period. The decline of multi-generational cohabiting families exactly mirrors the decline in farm employment. Children were no longer raised to assume economic roles. They were raised so that at adolescence they could fly from the nest, become independent, and seek partners of their own. They were raised not for embeddedness, but for autonomy. By the 1920s, the nuclear family, the nuclear family with a male breadwinner had replaced the corporate family as the dominant family form. So much here, but there's sort of two giant points he's making here. You know, one is that we have decided that it's a value to raise children to be hyper independent.
Yeah.
And
that this we're actually virtually failing if they stay.
Yeah. This is unquestioned. Yeah. Like I don't. People say, hey, I'm raising my kids to be as independent as possible. Everyone's going to cheer on that.
Yep.
That is not good, you guys. Like, there is a, we need to raise, human beings were designed by God to be interdependent.
Yeah.
It's super important that you have enough in yourself to contribute to the body, to the family, to the whole. But there's no structure that we were designed to primarily live in that is independent. It's always interdependent, whether it's the church or the family. And we pushed further and further into this independence. And then he says that, you know, basically that the nuclear family with the male breadwinner had replaced the corporate family. This is one of the things that, one of the reasons why I think the church that has become obsessed with the 1950s male breadwinner family is really taking us back to something that is so much still not designed around the way God had envisioned the family, is that it doesn't, there needs to be this economic center to the family where the family can work as a team, where the a husband and wife can contribute together. I know this is super hard for so many people listening to this. We are so far down this road of employment, employing the individual, and of not experiencing the family team in any kind of economic sense. And I think there are baby steps that families can take. We just got back from our integrated business owners mastermind, and a big part of what we're really helping each other think through is, okay, we have these businesses, and so there's business owners have a particular ability to integrate their family team in their economic life in a really exciting way. But for a lot of those guys, it's still a big struggle.
Yeah.
And so then it's like, okay, is there a new project that your family can endeavor that you can lean into that might start fairly small, but can involve the family working together in an economic sense that begin, instead of it just being your side hustle where you're out there, you know, not only as an individual being employed, but now you're also during your more discretionary time, spending more time as an individual.
Yeah.
Like this is critical. We need to find ways in which we are making money as a family team. We need to figure that out increasingly as your kids get older.
Yeah. And one thing I would say too, that I try to encourage people with, because they hear that and they go, oh, I work an office job and I work for employment. And so, man, am I not doing good enough, whatever. I would say sometimes actually that's better than trying to bring home like some business, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes I know guys who they can actually make more as like labor for hire than probably their business savvy or their entrepreneurship. But the difference is, don't just work at that office to pay the bills, work at that office to bankroll the vision for your family over the next 100 years.
Yes.
That's different. Divide, like I want to use my labor here to actually develop a centeredness of business,
that's
economy and stuff like that. And then one other thing I would say too, that is just a classic example I always think about of, that idea of like, it's one of the biggest things that bothers me right now is in culture, we so think it's a value, an unquestioned value of like, send the kids off, send them out, let them start on their own, blah, blah, blah. Right. And one really easy way to see that in a sliver of this that I think is a metaphor for all of kids' life is the inheritance discussion, right? Everyone always says like, the classic American thing is like, oh, you should never give more than 2 cents to your kids. Like you're just, you know what I mean? Like you're enabling them. You're just going to make them just comfy and cozy.
Right.
And I think all that's showing is like, I don't think anytime someone says that, they're showing their hands that they actually believe home is nothing more than a consumption vehicle.
That's right.
Right? You would only believe giving an inheritance to your kids is bad if you believe the whole purpose of a marriage and a family is to basically just eat it.
Right.
Like to spend it.
For our comfort.
Yeah, for comfort and whatever.
Yeah.
But if it's a resource for mission, if it's a resource for purpose, then why on earth would you not give everything you have, like go take it as far as you can and then hand the football off so they can go farther, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, and then you use the business metaphor and you realize how dumb it is, right? It's like, okay, let's say successful businesses, Apple, whoever, that basically once a CEO runs their life and gets to the finish line, that there was a rule where at the end, they basically said, okay, guys, I want to, because we actually applaud parents that do this, right? We applaud parents that stand up and say, okay, the next generation's not getting it. We're giving it all away.
Right.
We built all this stuff. We're gonna give it all away. What if Apple just says, okay, we built something really awesome. And now that I'm going to die tomorrow, you know, Tim Cook or Steve Jobs or whatever, well, we're just, you know, but we're going to go bankrupt and we're going to give it all away. We're just going to quit the company. We're going to take it all. You'd be, and then you would say like, yeah. And the next person has to pull out by their bootstraps and see if they can make it on their own. And then you just do that every generation. Yeah. You're like, that's the dumbest thing ever.
The reason is because there's a corporate memory inside of that business for how to steward those resources
and take them farther.
Yes. And they developed it over decades. And so at the peak of their ability to maximally steward the resources, you destroy the entity.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's our vision for the family.
Yes. And the businesses, usually, especially with stockholders and public companies like that, the main thing is growth, right? Now, we care about growth in a different way with a family, not like the wealth of the stockholder, but it's the similar thing of like, yeah, you know, a CEO who takes over a past generation CEO's vision knows he succeeded if he basically created growth. It's that simple. Right. Like, did I take it farther than it was before? And if he didn't, then you failed. It's pretty simple. And I think that's just what we should, how we should understand, you know, multi-generational aspects, giving resources to our kids spiritually or financially. But I just think like, yeah, if you put what we try to do with family into the business corporation, you'd be like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen. Well, why would we applaud that?
And the caveat to what Jeff is saying is that if you've raised your kids to think about money primarily as consumption, then give your money away. Like what we're saying is, like, is that if you've raised your kids to so that your ceiling is their floor, you've raised your kids in such a way that they are smarter stewards than you were, and they're on a trajectory.
And why would you file for bankruptcy? And give it all away.
How to like, who else is going to better fuel the kingdom than the family mission that you guys have been on for hopefully many years together? The family team has been blessed now with those resources. Continue to steward those resources. They're not yours. They belong to the Lord. They're the kingdom's resources. But it's the hope is that if you believed your children would be the stewards of kingdom resources, how would you raise them? Would you raise them to think about money primarily as a consumption vehicle, something for their comfort? And if you have raised them that way, that's kind of the cultural default. Like if you're wealthy, everything just upgrades and upgrades endlessly until we got a massive
yacht. Imagine, and back to that metaphor again, imagine if like Tim Cook comes in and all of a sudden Apple just starts failing like crazy, but yet he's walking away with $200 million checks every year. You'd be like, that's the consumption model, right? It's like that's him coming in and just saying, I'm going to do this for myself.
Milking that cow.
Hey guys, did you know that me and Jeremy created a special fatherhood masterclass we do online called The Skill of Fatherhood? If you want to immediately level up your father's skills and learn an entire system with tips and tricks and philosophy and help that we believe can fundamentally change your family's life forever, then this masterclass is for you. There's an entire module on the skill of training your kids with about 8 teaching videos in that one. There's an entire module you get on the skill of coaching your family as a team on mission with 8 or more videos in that one, including multiple interviews with a bunch of families doing this and how they do that. And an entire module on the skill of building multi-generational legacy and vision for your family with about 7 or 8 videos on that. The masterclass also comes with a workbook that walks you through the process so you never feel overwhelmed but feel equipped and encouraged and ready to start leading your family in a bigger and better direction starting today. And we wanted to hook you guys up. So our podcast listeners, if that's you and you're listening, we want to give you an exclusive deal that we aren't doing anywhere else online. So if you want to get $20 off the masterclass right now today, then head to familyteams.com and use the code DADS. That's DADS at familyteams.com. Again, that's the code DADS to get $20 off at familyteams.com.
So totally. Okay. Then he talks about that the nuclear family in the history of the world, this thing that we think is the ideal family, really only existed in that form for about 15 years of human history.
I love that.
So he says, for a time, this is David Brooks again, it all seemed to work. From 1950 to 1965, divorce rates dropped, fertility rates rose, and the American nuclear family seemed to be in wonderful shape. And most people seemed prosperous and happy. In these years, a kind of cult formed around this type of family. During this period, a certain family ideal became engraved in our minds. A married couple with 2.5 kids. When we think of the American family, many of us still revert to this ideal. When we have debates about how to strengthen the family, we are thinking of the two-parent nuclear family with 1 or 2 kids, probably living in some detached family home on some suburban street. We take it as the norm, even though this wasn't the way most humans lived during the tens of thousands of years before 1950. And it isn't the way most humans have lived during the 55 years since 1965.
Yeah. One thing he didn't tease out in there, I think, is explicit, is the reason why those 15 years were those 15 years. And I think the reason why it was right then is because it's obvious from data and economics and et cetera, that some economists even say that, and I would say 1945 to 1960, so similar, you know, 5-year difference, was the most kind of prolifically wealthy season of boom for our country. Meaning the middle class, everyone was comfortable, everyone was wealthy, everyone was growing. And I think those, and so the argument is, when you become so resourced and so lavish and so okay, then you don't need the extended family. Right. You don't need the help. You don't need the structure. You don't need the web.
Well, essentially what you had in those 15 years was an entire population that had grown up in extended families, but experienced enormous wealth.
Where they could do it on their own.
15 years where they could do it on their own. They didn't know what they were creating was going to actually like a be a downgrade.
Yes, exactly. And there's another economist I watched too, where he kind of tracks from this all the way to like today. And he kind of tracks this interesting kind of like bait and switch that happened with us, where that was the most prosperous times of all of history. Then you get this huge economic boom. Then in the 70s and 80s, because of that boom, people think they can kind of are invincible. And then they start actually moving away from extended family for jobs. So that was one of the first times in history where actually a job prospect was kind of like, I'm going to go there because of like the city centers, the urban. Mm-hmm. And so we all move away from our extended families. And then we spend a generation away from our families. And then all of a sudden we go into these bust cycles. And then you certainly have 2008 with the crisis and stuff like that, where basically he just kind of says we get left out in the cold. Like it was kind of like enormous boom. So then we move knowing we can do it on our own. And all of a sudden we're in a city where we basically can't do it on our own anymore. And we need help and we have no help. And I'm like, dang, that's fascinating. Right.
Yeah. He describes some of those things in this part about the disintegration after the 1965. He says, but these conditions did not last. The constellation of forces that had briefly shored up the nuclear family began to fall away, and the sheltered family of the 1950s was supplanted by the stressed family of every decade since. Some of the strains were economic. Starting in the mid-70s, young men's wages declined, putting pressure on working-class families in particular. The major strains were cultural. Society became more individualistic and more self-oriented. People put greater value on privacy and autonomy. A rising feminist movement helped endow women with greater freedom to live and work as they chose. Themes of putting family before self-dominated in the 1950s. Love means self-sacrifice and compromise. In the 1960s and in the 70s, putting self before family was prominent. Quote, love means self-expression and individuality. The number of divorces increased about 15-fold from 1870 to 1920 and then climbed more or less continuously through the first several decades of the nuclear family era. In 1850, 75% of Americans older than 65 lived with relatives. By 1990, only 18% did. Over the past two generations, families have also gotten a lot smaller. The general American birth rate is half of what it was in 1960. In 2012, most American family households had no children. There are more American homes with pets than with kids. So this disintegration started happening, and now we really are living in a culture that looks at family as a failed experiment, but what it's seeing as the failed experiment is the nuclear family of the 1950s.
Yeah.
There are just too many problems with that. We couldn't sustain that. We tried family. Now we got to try pets, or we got to try cohabitation. And instead of going back to the way family has been for virtually all of human history, this classical family that lived as a multi-generational team, as an extended family unit, most people really don't have a vision for that.
Yeah.
They don't have a living memory of what that was like. And so we're really dying from a lack of imagination. We don't see what we've left behind.
Well, and I think what's interesting too is we kind of created a family as a product. Right? Almost like a family that could give us what we want. This nuclear, beautiful, cute, Norman Rockwell style painting, right? And then when that product starts failing, what do we do with products that start failing? We throw them out. They're cheap, they're whatever, you know.
We innovate. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we say that it must be something new. When I think we need to, when it was less about family being some picturesque ideal of this product we created, but family being more about woven into the fabric of the universe. Because, and you know what's one interesting thing too, that I always notice with the debate on like nuclear family versus, you know, extended, et cetera, is even like when we go around and we talk about family a lot, you start using those words. And sometimes those words are like family is sometimes triggering for people. They go, oh, well, I'm single. What about me? What about me? You know, and all this stuff like that. And I immediately, that always is a tell. That's always, again, them showing their cards of like, oh, you think family is mom, dad, and two kids.
Right.
Right. When I think family is a last name.
Right.
So there's literally not one human on this planet
right.
who is not part of one.
That's right.
But we've created such a weird, funky divide because we have a vision of the 1950s family where there is a lot of people that don't fit that. There's a ton of people that don't fit the 1950s family.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot more space and grace for everyone to fit in the family of God's design, right? Yes. It's like different economic statuses fit in every part of the family. Single, married, divorced, kid, grandparent, etc. So I just find that fascinating of like, it's one of the most, the biblical vision of family is one of the most inclusive visions for any person,
yeah.
right? And then the 1950s vision of family is one of the most exclusive visions for family. I just find that interesting.
Oh, that's a really good point, man. Well, then he goes on and kind of drops this bomb, which I felt was, so the first one that he hit was such a good definition. The nuclear family ideal that we all think is sort of this family. It's a 15-year sort of weird glitch in historical time. Then he goes on to say today, the way that there's basically two ways that people have handled this. There's the wealthier affluent way, and there's a sort of the working class or sort of the way in which those who are more in poverty have handled this transition. So let's talk through this. He says affluent people have the resources to effectively buy extended family in order to shore themselves up. Think of all the child rearing labor affluent parents now buy that used to be done by extended kin, babysitting, professional childcare, tutoring, coaching, therapy, expensive after school programs. For that matter, think of the affluent that can hire therapists and life coaches for themselves as replacement for kin or close friends. These expensive tools and services not only support children's development and help prepare them to compete in the meritocracy by reducing stress and time commitments for parents, they preserve the amity of marriage. Affluent conservatives often pat themselves on the back for having stable nuclear families. They preach that everybody else should build stable families too. But then they ignore one of the main reasons their own families are stable. They can afford to purchase the support that extended families used to provide and that the people they preach at further down the income scale cannot.
So good. And I love too how it cuts both ways. Like he even said, I love how he indicts the conservative model because so many times, like we said at the beginning, even the Christian model that's conflated with the conservative model can sometimes, cultural Christian, believe that the nuclear family is the good thing, right? And he basically says that, like, no, it's about this extended family the extended family, the corporate family was this vision of, like, all of life and teaching and education and work and economy and all these different things. And of course, you'd go outside of that, but there was such a center of that that I think it was really strong. And I think I love... where he just comes hard on that side of, like, most people who do pat themselves on the back for having a cute little, you know, married family with kids realistically don't realize how much they're filling in the gaps just because with resources, not because they're any better or any special. Like, basically everyone would be probably in the same position based on economic ability.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the litmus tests for this is the phrase that is used by families. I don't want to be a burden.
Yeah.
That's basically another tell.
Like, isn't that the point?
Yeah, that nuclear family is the ideal, and that the ideal is a nuclear family that can completely be autonomous with no needs.
Our goal is actually to try to get to not be needed.
That's right. And so part of what you have to do, guys, if you start to value this, is you actually want to value the areas both in your life, your parents' life, your extended family's life, where you guys need each other.
Yeah.
Like, oh, there's a major childcare problem here. How can our family absorb that? Oh, you know, we have an economic problem with a family member. How can we help with that? Oh, we have an aging family member. We have a special needs child in the family, extended family. How can we all rally around that? These things that create like a lot more time, energy, and money needs, these things should be seen as tools for creating multi-generational and extended family bonds. Bonds are created because of needs, vulnerability, and then the decision to wade in to those needs and begin to self-sacrificially meet those needs. That's what creates really powerful family bonds.
Yeah.
You need to need each other. And so this value that says, I hope if you're, man, if somebody's coming over to my house and for my extended family and they feel like they're trying, but they're really struggling and they need my help. If you sort of pretend like that is a bad thing and that, man, you need to be completely autonomous. Again, this isn't saying laziness or one of these other problems that that could really have sort of a moral dimension. But man, we all struggle. We all have days. We just did a 5-Minute Fatherhood on a dad who asks, what do I do when I have to go to work and my kids and my wife are all sick? And of course, the first question is, do you live close to extended family?
Yeah, totally.
That's a great situation. Like, it's not your fault. You need to go to work. We get it. You know, but you need help.
Yeah.
And so I hope you have extended family. And if you don't, I hope you have a strong Christian community. But again, we're trying to reshape what we are perceiving as the ideal.
Yeah.
Okay. So then he goes on and starts to make some amazing summary statements. So Brooks says, when you put everything together, we're likely living through the most rapid change in family structure in human history. The causes are economic, cultural, and institutional all at once. People who grow up in a nuclear family tend to have a more individualistic mindset than people who grow up in a multi-generational extended clan. People with an individualistic mindset tend to be less willing to sacrifice self for the sake of the family, and the result is more family disruption. People who grow up in disrupted families have more trouble getting the education they need to have prosperous careers. People who don't have prosperous careers have trouble building stable families because of financial challenges and other stressors. The children in those families become more isolated and more traumatized. The people who suffer the most from the decline in family support are the vulnerable, especially children. In 1960, roughly 5% of children were born to unmarried women. Now about 40% are. American children are more likely to live in a single-parent house than children from any other country. So, man, he's just saying, we have to be aware that the decision to not sacrifice for family, to lift up individualism and complete self-sufficiency as the goal, that kind of freedom to indulge our impulses, that's the goal, has wrecked children.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think, and that's the thing we have to keep coming back to, is we always think about it from the mom and the dad perspective when you have to ask yourself, what is this doing to kids, right? Because that's the next generation. That's where we're going next. That's what we're creating. That's the next, you know, that's our the leaders of the next generation. And so I think, yeah, I think that's a huge one we never consider. Even thinking that stat too, the, you know, 5% of kids were married, or I mean, roughly 5% of children were born to unmarried women in 1960. Now it's about 40%. I mean, that's an enormous stat difference, right? In what, 50, 60 years. And it's like, yeah. And so many times it's just fascinating to think of, we've kind of shifted the, oh, what do I need? What might I need to sacrifice, or what decisions should I make based on what it might happen to other people versus me, to now being like, how can I get what I want at the expense of others?
Right.
And now it's a lot of times our kids.
That's right. Yeah. And then he goes on to kind of talk about the effect on men. I really thought this was interesting. He said, consider single men. Extended families provided men with the fortifying influences of male bonding and female companionship. Today, many American males spend the first 20 years of their life without a father and the next 15 without a spouse.
Oh, so good.
Man. Kay Heimowitz of the Manhattan Institute has spent a good chunk of her career examining the wreckage caused by the decline of the American family and cites evidence showing that in the absence of the connection and meaning that family provides, unmarried men are less healthy, alcohol and drug abuse are common, earn less, and die sooner than married men. So, man, this has not been good news for single men. I mean, this idea that you spend 20 years without a dad and then 15 years without a spouse, it breaks my heart. I mean, I think that guys who are in that state, like, we're not designed to live that way. Like, we need each other. But, man, we had a whole conversation around the idea that prisons are sort of centers for the dad-deprived male.
Yeah.
It's impossible to, I feel like, overstate the impact this has had on boys and young men, and then the subsequent impact it's had on our society, because so many of our problems, from drug abuse to crime, are really a direct result of the disintegration of the family.
Yeah. One, I feel like, too, one thing we don't talk about enough is how family gives a channel for maleness and fatherhood and all these things to play out.
Yeah.
That then comes out sideways without that, right? Yeah. Comes out in aggression, like you said, crime, stuff like that. And I always find that fascinating. Of a lot of, not saying that every guy needs to get married, not saying that all that, but there is a general macro level truth that, like, there is a channeling of wisdom and maturity that happens when men focus their energy here and build this,
the civilizing influence,
versus something else.
That's right. Yeah. Men were. I really think so. Most men, in order to mature, need to be needed.
Totally.
Like, they need to feel the weight of responsibility on their shoulders and oftentimes there's a father who encourages a man, a young boy or a young man, to stand up under that weight. And then they do, and then as they little by little work to support, you know, a young family, they become to mature. And that's really the way that God has designed most men, their discipleship path. Like that is, yep. that is what makes them mature. He also says many mothers who decide to raise their young children without extended family nearby find that they have chosen a lifestyle that is brutally hard and isolating. So of course the implications for mothers are also,
and that's something we've talked about a lot of that all of these changes have always historically made it worse on the mom, more isolated, more brutal work. They're the ones that seem to take all the work.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And kind of the last summary statement says about this point is in 2004, the journalist and urbanist Jane Jacobs, who I love, I don't know if you've ever read any of her books.
No, not a ton.
Oh my
no.
gosh. Yeah. So she published in her final book, an assessment of North American society called Dark Ages Ahead. At the core of her argument was the idea that families are, quote, rigged to fail. The structures that once supported the family no longer exist. So Jane Jacobs was, she lived in Manhattan. She really was the one who single-handedly stopped the interstate freeway from going through lower Manhattan.
Wow.
She wrote this amazing book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And really described basically city design, urban design, and what makes a flourishing urban center. And she saw the transition generationally from sort of the old cities into the horrible designs that were basically erupting in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But so she's very respected. And I agree that there's a sentiment here, and this was so hard, you guys, that we have to absorb this reality. And that is that there's a sense in which it when she says it's rigged to fail, that's just another way of saying, if you go down that, you know, that stream that Jeff was talking about, it's not going to end well.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to raise the red flag and say, guys, you need to intentionally begin to craft a different vision for your family, because where this is headed is dangerous. Rapids ahead. It's not going to work.
Yeah.
There's so many problems. Well, we've already run the experiment. Yep. It's like
and
a disaster.
The dad is out. Yeah, the jury. Yeah.
Oh man. Okay. And then he goes on to really talk about, you know, kind of the conservative ideas, and goes deeper into, hey, these are not necessarily going to solve the problem. As the social structures that support the family have decayed, the debate about it has taken on mythical quality. Social conservatives insist that we can bring the nuclear family back, but the conditions that made for stable nuclear families in the 1950s are never returning. Conservatives have nothing to say to the kid whose dad is split, whose mom has had three other kids with different dads. Go live in a nuclear family is really not relevant advice. If only a minority of households are traditional nuclear families, that means the majority are something else. Single parent, never married parents, blended families, grandparent-headed families, serial partnerships, and so on. Conservative ideas have not caught up with this reality. The sexual revolution has come and gone, and it's left us with no governing norms of family life, no guiding values, no articulated ideals. On the most central issues, our shared culture often has nothing relevant to say, and so for decades, things have been falling apart. And so I just want to say, you guys, so when he says the sexual revolution has come and gone, left us with no governing norms of family life, and really describes that there is no clear answer to this, this is where I find the fact that we believe God wrote a book and that there is divine revelation that helps us articulate the architecture of the family so encouraging. Because he's saying, guys, we can't go back. But the whole point of being a believer is somebody who's trying to understand the mind and heart of God, their father, and trying to build their life around the values and the beliefs that God articulates as our father, the stories that he's given us. And so my hope isn't where really David Brooke goes from here, which is really, we're going to innovate our way out of this. I have no hope that we're going to innovate our way out of this. We need revelation from God. We need God's word. The Bible has preserved for every believer a great articulation of God's vision of the family. And so part of what we're just doing is we have just neglected all the elements of scripture that has really clearly stated the way we are to live. And it's not in this sort of hyper individualistic way. There's a design for family. We need to re-understand it, recapture it, and begin to reinstitute it and move toward that design. And as we do, and we have seen this, you guys, through our work with family teams, it does lead to greater flourishing. Now, there is generational destruction. In other words, when he says, what are you going to say to that, you know, that kid whose dad is split? And the fact is, you cannot fix in 1 year what it took a generation to destroy. it's going to take a generation to rebuild. And so we do have a solution for that person, but it's not the solution that, hey, just, you know, find a forged community somewhere and everything will be okay. Like you're going to have to go through a process of rebuilding your family line, and you can do it. And we do need to, through the church, through a larger community and our spiritual family, begin to shore up the kinds of things, disciple those folks back into God's design and God's vision. But this is going to be hard to recover.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think too, there's this tension when you read something like this, or when you think about the nuclear family, to want to go like that conservative point of like wanting to go back. Yeah. Right. And I think what we have to realize as Jesus followers is that we don't go back, we go forward. Right. And not just forward into like, oh yeah, charge ahead, but like we actually have the end of the story that then we can work backwards from. So I think we go forwards to go backwards. And what I mean by that is like, we know that we're going to this garden city, to this huge, almost like heavenly urban development, right? Of just like families and multi-generations and working and being under your own fig tree, like we talked about today, and all these different things, and the bride and the bridegroom and a family together, and the feast and the table and all that. So now that we know that's where we're going, then we can now work backwards of like, okay, how do I reverse engineer that? And we can even go past where we're at now to go farther back into the Tereic vision and stuff like that, to see the wisdom of like, oh, there is blueprints, there is a lot of seeds of how to build this, not to go back to an ideal, but just to read like the wisdom books that tell us where to go. And I think that's a big difference.
That's right. So I'll just read you guys David Brooks's conclusion, some of the things he says towards the end of the article, and then we'll close up. But it says, for those who are not privileged, the era of isolated nuclear family has been a catastrophe. It's led to broken families or no families, to merry-go-round families that leave children traumatized and isolated, to senior citizens dying alone in a room. All forms of inequality are cruel, but family inequality may be the cruelest. It damages the heart. Eventually, family inequality even undermines the economy the nuclear family was meant to serve. Children who grew up in chaos have trouble becoming skilled, stable, and socially mobile employees later on. When we discuss the problems confronting the country, we don't talk about family enough. It feels too judgmental, too uncomfortable, maybe even too religious. But the blunt fact is that the nuclear family has been crumbling in slow motion for decades, and many of our other problems with education, mental health, addiction, the quality of the labor force stem from that crumbling. We've left behind the nuclear family paradigm of 1955. For the most part, it's not coming back. Americans are hungering to live in extended families in ways that are new and ancient at the same time. This is a significant opportunity, a chance to thicken and broaden family relationships, a chance to allow more adults and children to live and grow under the loving gaze of a dozen pair of eyes and be caught when they fall by a dozen pair of arms. For decades, we have been eating at smaller and smaller tables with fewer and fewer kin. It's time to find ways to bring back the big tables.
Such a good ending. I loved the dozens of eyes with the dozens of arms. That's so true. Of like creating, I just kept getting this picture of a web, right? That you're trying to create this web of relationships, right? And the webs are interconnected. There's one connection point here, but there's one over here, but there's one there, and it goes in a circle, but it goes across the aisle. Like, and man, creating that web is the holy vision, a web of intergenerational relationships, interpersonal relationships, different ages, different ways, you know, personal relationships, economic relationships. The family's meant to kind of orbit on all of these fronts.
Yeah.
And I love that.
That's so beautiful. And that big table. I mean, you guys, the first thing that we...
Yeah, practically, just build a big table.
Yeah.
Start inviting people.
And so you can do this. This is in, within the realm of possibility for virtually every family, is to invite people to your table, to create that family meal once a week. One of the things that we do, you guys, in the Family Teams Weekend, the one in Cincinnati, is it was really fun. So on Saturday night at the very end, we end our weekend, and we actually put a bunch of tables on the stage. One of the tables is for my family, and we have everyone who comes to our Shabbat regularly, which is called our Shabbat squad, but it's our family of seven, plus usually a niece, a nephew, an aunt, and then grandparents from both sides. And so we just kind of let the mic go around the table, and just asked, you know, it's a big table, and to eat at that table, you know, virtually every week, and to be forging the relationships that oftentimes we forge maybe at Thanksgiving once a year or something, on a continual basis. It took us a long time to figure that out. But and we had to take little baby steps, you know. A lot of times it starts with paper plates and pizza night with the kids, and then it works its way towards a multi-generational epic family meal 10 years later. But man, you guys, there's hope for this. And I've seen so many families reestablish the tool of the table.
Mm.
And we want to leave you guys with hope, not discouragement. One of the great things about being in the kingdom of God is that one of our jobs is to be a light in the darkness.
Yeah.
And we should not be worried if it's getting darker, as long as our light's not getting dimmer.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we need our light to be really, really bright. And so we want to equip you guys to do this. I encourage you guys, if you haven't been to a Family Teams weekend,
yes,
to get some of these tools, to begin to live into a 7-day rhythm, to begin to figure out how to steward your family table in such a way that it will result ultimately in the establishment of a extended family, a multi-generational family experience. We really want to see you guys get back to the way God designed the family and get out of this sort of dead end that our culture has unfortunately migrated into with our obsession around individualism. And I really just want to say thanks to David Brooks,
yeah,
for dropping this bomb. I constantly was hoping that really Christian theologians and, yeah, those who are, you know, are speaking on behalf of the family for the believers would be finding these things in Scripture and pointing them out. But I just haven't seen that, yeah, hardly at all. And so so Jeff and I are constantly encouraging that Christians and Christian ministries that are, yeah, really family oriented would stop, would understand that, that all the little sort of enrichment things that we're trying to encourage families with are still trying to build or recapture that. It's sort of the assumptive 1950s nuclear family, and it's just not going to work. And so we have to say that's not the target. The target is the multi-generational team on mission, and that's what the Bible describes family as being ideally, and so we have got to find a way to recapture that and get back to that.
Yeah, I would just say the same thing, of we need to stop trying to build the nuclear family and start building something bigger, something better, something holier, and something that captures a lot more people. So, yeah, love you guys.
All right, guys, that's all we have for today's episode. Remember, you have what it takes as a father equipped by the Holy Spirit to lead your family as a multi-generational team on mission. And as always, remember to let us know what you thought about today's episode at Family Teams on Instagram, at Family Teams on Facebook. Search for us there, easy to find, and you will find us. And let us know what you thought, whether something that stood out, something that was encouraging, or some feedback you would like to give us. All right, have a great rest of the day.